and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, four Alaskan servicemen and women who recently returned from Afghanistan share insights on their overseas duty. Recorded on January 11th at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage, listen to Alaskans on the Ground, Experiences in Afghanistan, coming up next on KSKA's Addressing Alaskans, after the news. This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans. This week's program was recorded at the Alaska World Affairs Council on January 11th.
Hello, my name is Lisa Falsko. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska World Affairs Council.
And it's such a pleasure to see everyone here today and so many students from our JROTC programs. Thank you for coming. If you could please take a moment to, at this time, turn off your cell phones. Today's program is being recorded for KSKA, so if you could just put your phone on vibrate, that would be greatly appreciated by our radio listeners at home. And if you could please wait for the microphone during the Q&A, we will be recording the questions at the end as well. And I'd like to thank William Toyer for doing the recording of this program, which you'll be able to download and listen to on the alaskapublic.org website or on the Alaska World Affairs Council website. At this time, I'd like to hand over the microphone to Major Kautzman, who is our moderator for today's program. Enjoy.
Good afternoon. First, I would like to say thank you for everyone who's out here. I think Alaska has been one of those duty stations that I can definitely say I'm part of the community. Each time I go from the redeployment ceremony to the when we came back, there were so many Alaskans who just would always say, thank you for your service. Thank you. So I say thank you back to you. Thank you for accepting the military and making this a home for us. Today we're going to be talking about our experiences in Afghanistan. Each of us has a different story. On this panel, we have experiences ranging from an engineer who did support and maintenance working with the Afghans for engineering. We had a medical support who taught the Afghan army how to do first aid, as well as treating our own patients. We had another who advised and mentored the Afghan National Police, did numerous patrols as a military policeman, as well as myself, who worked with governance and development throughout Afghanistan. First, we're going to go through and do introductions. I'm Major Jeanette Kautzman. I just redeployed in October. I'm part of 425 Brigade, and I work as a civil military affairs officer. My duties and responsibilities in Afghanistan were synchronizing a lot of the efforts between Department of State, United States, Agency for International Development, United States Department of Agriculture, other non-governmental organizations, the International Committee of the Red Cross, as well as getting all of those synchronized with the Afghan government. So in ways that seems significant, however, it's people that really make everything work together. And along with that, I also worked with the Afghan Reintegration Program, where we worked with the local Afghan nationals, Afghan local police, to reintegrate insurgencies back into and form allegiances back to the Afghanistan government. And lastly, another significant accomplishment was working with the female engagement teams. I was the officer in charge for those females who were out on the front lines working side by side with the infantry soldiers and getting that accomplished. My previous assignments have been working, I was deployed to Croatia as well as the Philippines outside of Afghanistan. Thank you.
Good afternoon, I'm Sergeant First Class Vetterkind, and again, I also appreciate you guys coming out today. I've been in for about 15 years now. Completed my third deployment, which would be my second combat tour. I spent 1 year from 2003 to 2004 in Iraq, and 10 to 11 in Afghanistan. This deployment, I served as a squad leader, which had roughly 12 to 16 soldiers under me when we conducted patrols. I worked with the Afghan Uniform Police in the Lagman province for about 3 months, where we were able to transition power back to the Afghan government in Lagman. We then moved over to Parwan province outside of Bagram Airfield, where we worked with the Afghan Army, conducting security and making sure that that the airbase had stayed safe. Let me see. But in a nutshell, that's basically what I did during my time over there.
I'm Captain Shannon Osterfeld. I'm currently serving for the brigade nurse with the 125 Striker Brigade Combat Team up at Fort Wainwright. I deployed in support of OEF, or Operation Enduring Freedom, 11-12. I returned about 9 months ago. This was my only deployment. While I was deployed, I had a wide variety of duties. When I first got into country, I was in Zabul province, and I was the OIC of an aid station on our base. We were co-located with a naval forward surgical team, so my team provided all the routine medical care, kind of the boring stuff, for the soldiers on our base, and then we assisted the forward surgical team, who took care of all the trauma patients. We assisted them by transporting their patients to and from the helipad. We augmented their staff during mass cal events, and we operated their walking blood bank program. As my brigade transitioned down further into southern Afghanistan, I moved down to the Panjwai district, and while down there, I established a new aid station at the base that we were at. We did not have surgical support while we were there, so we took care of all patients that came in. While our brigade headquarters was conducting split operations, I assisted them by coordinating medevac requests across our new battle space. I also traveled to pieces of remote tactical infrastructure where we had medics that were operating independently, and I went and I assisted the medics with whatever they needed. So I trained them on the medications they had on hand. I helped them set up or organize their small aid stations. I reviewed mass cal plans with them, ensured that their casualty collection points had everything they needed. Basically, whatever they needed help with, I helped them. And I also taught first aid classes to the Afghan Uniform Police down in Panjwai. I did a train-the-trainer class with them even, which was kind of fun. And I, along with our brigade surgeon, he and I put together an advanced trauma life support team within our brigade, which we used to support our brigade during deliberate combat operations. So that's it.
Hello. Thank you, everybody, for being here again. My name is Senior Master Sergeant Chad Anderson with the 477th Civil Engineering Unit on the base, reservist here. So I've been in Anchorage, Eagle River for about 10 years now. So it's my home now. This deployment was my third, my first two being in went to Baghdad, Iraq, second to Kirkuk in northern Iraq. Being in a civil engineering unit, normally our job is to go in, set up tent cities, run power, water, pretty much make sure everybody can just live the best we can in the situation we're in. The last deployment this previous year, January 12 to September, I was tasked to ISAF headquarters in an Army billet to, layman's terms, I was pretty much supervisor of all the maintenance for ISAF headquarters and NATO facilities throughout. Being joint, had the opportunity with over 40 countries within our camp there and throughout the Kabul area. Supervising locally 46 Afghans every day that would come on the base. We would train them and pretty much provide the maintenance as we go along, training them as plumbers, electricians, HVAC. Just teaching them a skill and then taking care and providing support to the base at the same time. That's pretty much all I got with this one. Not a great speaker.
Yes, thank you. As you can see, each of us has a very unique and different experiences that we had in Afghanistan. Those experiences, however, are interconnected with the sense that we all work with Afghans. And so that's going to be our first topic of discussion, is our experiences with the local Afghans and how they helped us and influenced us, as well as how we helped them.
So I worked with the Afghans in a couple different capacities. First, obviously, was when we took care of them as patients. Took care of them as patients, because we treated both U.S. coalition forces and Afghans. So taking care of them as patients was very difficult many times. Just the language barrier made it difficult. But one thing I noticed very early on when we took care of them, especially in their kids, they would come in with these horrible injuries, and they were very stoic, which is not what I'm used to seeing. I'm an ER nurse, so back here in the States, see people come into the ER for all sorts of crazy things. And these kids come in, or adults too, with gunshot wounds, blast injuries, even kids with, like, where they fell out of trees or whatever and broken bones. And they'd come in and wouldn't shed a tear. You'd put IVs in them, you'd be playing with their broken arms, straightening it out, and they might grimace a little bit, but wouldn't even shed a tear. So it was very different dealing with them as patients. I also worked with them as students when I taught the first aid classes, and they were always so thankful for everything we did. They wanted to learn. They wanted your approval. So it was kind of fun teaching them, even though it was very difficult, again, with the language stuff, the language barrier. When we would practice the skills that I taught them, they always wanted your approval. It was kind of fun. It was almost like working with a little kid in some respects. You would have them, you know, we'd practice bandaging a head wound, and they couldn't wait for you to come look at it, and you'd be looking at somebody else's, and you have people tapping you on your shoulder. You're like, come here, look at me, look at mine, look how well I did. And as soon as you looked at the partners, the other one was taking the bandage off, like, watch me, watch me. So it was actually, I had a really good time teaching the classes. It was very rewarding. So,
some of the different interactions I've had from throughout the rest of this, when I refer to the Afghan Unified or Uniformed Police, I'll just call them the AUP. It's a little bit easier. With our 3 months of dealing with the AUP, one of the things that we did was take them out into their villages, their communities, teach them how to be police. A lot of what we did was take these AUP out there with their patrols, and teach them how to actually interact with their own populace, which was, as we'll touch on a little bit, was a little bit more difficult than I actually imagined it would be. Just a culture barrier thing, something that we're used to that they're not. And on a day-to-day, a lot of it was us dealing with the AUP and going out, taking them into the communities to actually talk and interact with the villagers and see what type of problems that they were having, so we could teach them how to fix the problems. Once we left the working with the AUP and started working with the Afghan Army, or ANA, it was a lot different interaction. Interactions were a little bit more, I'd say, blunt, in-your-face type interactions. We went from teaching law enforcement to teaching combat. So the second 9 months of the tour was more or less raids, combat patrols, teaching the Afghan Army, the ANA, how to conduct those things. So the interactions in the second half, the last 9 months, weren't as, I'd say, rewarding as maybe the first 3 months. Nobody wants somebody kind of coming in their house unannounced. And working with the ANA, that's some of the things that we ended up having to do. So.
The ANA is the Afghan National Army.
As far as my day-to-day job, making a difference, like I said, I had 46 local Afghans that had to come on base every day. They had to go through body scanners, the retina scans, just to get into work every day. So for them it was a stressful process, but just to show you they wanted to be there, they would do this every day, sometimes hour and a half to get into base, to get to work. Most of them eager to learn, and they are happy that we are there. I'm not going to say it's all positive reactions, because we all know it's not, but I would say 90% of my guys, they're happy that we're there, happy to learn a trade, something that they can use when we're gone, because in reality, we're not always going to be over there. So it's giving them skills to maintain their lives. So being with them every day, I'm close with them. I'm Facebook friends with a couple of them. So, I mean, you do meet friends, and some of them are, like one of my guys that runs my customer service section, he spoke 8 languages. He'd been on ISF headquarters for over 8 years. So he was an asset, but he's always happy. But people like that, they'll be my friends for a long time. It's positive in that way. Knowing the chaplain that was actually on the camp there, I volunteered to go with him. I went to a couple of schools delivering school supplies, soccer balls, whatnot. My reserve unit here and some of the local community here would send me boxes of just school stuff, and I got to go deliver that to a couple of schools throughout Kabul. I would say 90% positive for me, which is good. And just being in that environment, I was happy to be there. I feel like I did make a difference over there as far as just relationships, and I'm just happy I got to go do what I did. So.
Thank you. As for me, I think I have 2 experiences that I would like to share. The first one would be working with the Afghan National Army. I remember the first time I went, we were breaking fast after Ramadan, and I was with the soldiers from the Afghan military. And they were just so intrigued of me because I have my weapons, and I walk in and they're just looking at me as if I was an alien. They couldn't truly understand who I was, what I was doing, why a woman would be in this uniform, not in the house. However, that's where that cultural understanding, that's what we're doing here today as well. We're trying to understand and get to know our stories. And it was me sharing that stories of, this is why I joined the military. This is what I'm doing. This is what I enjoy. And I think it broke so many barriers that so many of the Afghans just didn't understand as far as women in the military, the United States. It was probably one of those positive influences. And I remember they just would come up to me and just kind of touch me to see if I really was a real person. So that's a positive. And then they also understood, and I said, well, what's wrong with females being in the military? They said, well, that's just not accepted. They should be at home. And I said, well, maybe. I said, I'm not here to change your culture. However, just understand that it's okay to be in the military as well. So that's my first experience. And I think my second experience was just as rewarding, and it goes along the same lines. I work closely with the Afghan women and doing a lot with the other agencies, United States government, as well as the United Nations. And working with them, we had all of Afghanistan and all of the provinces sent representatives, Afghan women representatives, to share their ideas of where to go forward. In 2014, there's possibly a female Afghan running for president. So things like that, there's a general who's in the military that I sat and talked to for a while, and she said, so many Americans look at the Afghans and Afghan women and feel sorry for them. She said, don't feel sorry for us. Be proud. Like, we're here and we're leading, and those words like never truly, I didn't understand them at first. However, then you start really thinking about it, and they're leaders within their own ways. And that's what we need them to continue to do, take responsibility for the country. And these women were just incredible. They had ideas of how to run the governance, how to bring in some of the farming communities where women are still in full burqas and are not able to walk around without a male escort. If you would go downtown and host that, the women would, if they weren't with their male escorts, they would have to sit, squat, face a wall because they weren't allowed to wander through the city. But those women, they said, this is our culture and we're proud of it. And we'll accept it and we'll move forward at our pace. don't push us too hard. And I think that's one of the things that I came back and I thought that that's what we need to really focus on. It can't be our way. We somewhat try to push our agenda too quickly. And so if you truly listen to the people, and I think this goes into our next question of what we're going to go into is the challenges that we had. And I think that's probably going to be one of the challenges is for me is that we try to push things too quickly. Let them take the lead. And I think you'll probably learn more. I learn more from them than they probably learn from me. The next idea is going to be going over the challenges that we had in Afghanistan.
Some of the different challenges I saw, one I would have to say the weather. Mid-June, it hit 148 degrees with a heat index, 124 degrees regular temperature. Our thermometers stop at 125 and at 150. I was a little concerned when I looked at them, and I was like, that's got to be wrong. It was not wrong. So the heat dealing with your equipment, but definitely on your personnel, us and on the Afghans. The AUP, we would go out there for patrols. We would manage to get out there despite not wanting to sit there and try and soak up whatever AC we possibly could. And the not wanting to actually go out, put on their gear, and walk around in it. I don't really blame them. I didn't want to either. But just getting past the weather aspect, and then the winter, it gets pretty cold. So you go from 148 in the summer, and then it drops down to freeze in the wintertime. The other big challenge that I saw dealing with the AUP definitely had to have been kind of, as I saw it, a little bit of a lack of understanding of the concept of law and order. From what I saw, the culture, everything they deal with, any problem that they have, they go through the village elder to solve. Whether it's somebody had stolen something, a dispute over livestock, whatever it might be, they all sat down with the village elder to discuss it, and then really he is the one that resolved it. So now we're teaching them how to go out and actually help solve the problems themselves. And it was extremely difficult for them to actually pick up that whole concept. They've been at war for quite some time. So most of the stuff that they wanted to do as policemen, they would tend to go back to the combat, the infantry style things to try and solve the problem. Somebody did something, try and bust down the door and use all force necessary to be able to do it. And us trying to teach them, no, stop, slow down. There's a different way of doing it. There's another way of doing it. But like I said, trying to teach them a concept that most had no clue about, as I saw it, that was probably for me the biggest challenge that I saw. But the heat was pretty ridiculous.
So I think my biggest challenge was the language barrier, which I kind of mentioned already. But we didn't always have interpreters readily available because we didn't know when patients, that you don't plan for patients to come in all the time. So sometimes it was difficult to get an interpreter. And even when we had interpreters, their abilities varied so greatly. And then none of them really could translate the medical stuff well. I mean, I know people here in America, when they talk to medical people, are like, okay, can you please kind of tell me what that means? What you said just makes no sense. So imagine trying to do that with an interpreter who doesn't speak English well at all, and probably he may not even speak the language that your patient speaks. Where I was down in Panjwa, it was mostly Pashto speaking. However, there was still a lot of Dari and Farsi down there. So we had many times where the patient spoke one language, the interpreter spoke another, and neither of them spoke English very well. I had the same problem when I was teaching classes. I had one first aid class where my interpreter, he was hired for Pashto. His Pashto wasn't very good. He was better at Farsi. I had written materials in Pashto and Dari. Nobody in the class spoke Pashto, and nobody in the class could read. So it was basically all demonstration and pictures and kind of pointing. And I mean, they got by because a lot of the languages are kind of similar, so they can get the gist a little bit. But it was very difficult not speaking the language at all. So
I think one of my biggest challenges with my 46 local Afghans, once a month, the base commander actually allowed them to have a forum at the base, at one of the base theaters. They would have like a pretty much a town hall meeting, letting them express their wants and needs. You know, they've kind of caught on to. I laughed and told them that we'd Americanize them, but they, I mean, they would like want health care benefits and whatnot. So it's kind of funny in a way, but you know, in a way, you kind of think, well, you know, they're wising up as far as this goes. They're smart enough to get on the internet and see, well, you know, in the U.S., you guys have health care and this. So it's kind of funny. I mean, these would last 2 and 3 hours, and I would joke with the colonel there because I told him he had opened it up. So it's his can of worms, you know, so to speak. Just to give you just kind of a reality check, these guys made on base working for me like about 10 times what they would make downtown, and it was like €300 a month, which roughly $450 U.S. That's what they made a month, and they were living the dream, you know. The other challenges would be getting parts there to like keep, you know, in reality, like a garrison command is keeping a command running with local parts. And if you order, say, an air conditioner, say a Samson, just a brand name, you didn't know if that's what you were getting because there's so many copies, and you try to go local parts to like put money into the economies. Just because you order it and it says the name on there, that don't mean that's what it is most of the time. So sometimes you may replace an air conditioner 3 times to get one that works. So this, as far as parts, getting parts there and keeping a pretty much a 4-star command running with limited parts from downtown and not being able to just go to Home Depot or Lowe's, that was my biggest challenges, was keeping a base running with pretty much minimal parts.
Real quickly, I kind of while sitting here thought of another challenge that I had, and one of the, I said it was a pretty scary challenge trying to move about within the country. The way the infrastructure is set up is, it's insane, it really is. From the different wadis that they have that you've heard about IEDs, what, I swear there's an IED just about in every single one of them I drove past. Also, the roads, we call them switchbacks, what are probably the only time I've ever been scared over there was driving on the switchbacks, which is going to be a road that's, the outer edge of the road is a cliff that drops off a few hundred feet or 1,000 feet, depending on the mountain. And with the just the size of our vehicles, trying to be able to maneuver either through villages and not destroy the villages, or maneuver through the switchbacks and not plunge, you know, a few hundred feet off of a cliff. But trying to maneuver through the country was extremely difficult, whether we were in Lagman province or over in Parwan province. No matter where we're at, most of the time we're trying to take an account, not just destroying their infrastructure, which I'd say the vast majority of the time we were extremely successful in. Sometimes just, you know, things happen, nothing you can do. But that made it, while out there trying to train them, extremely difficult to do it.
As for me, I think one of the biggest challenges was getting them to take the ownership. The international community has been a part of Afghanistan for such a long time. A lot of the infrastructure that has been developed, a lot of the schools have been developed because of the international community there. That's part of just what we do, what USAID does, as well as the rest of the United Nations, everyone else. However, getting the governance portion to take that ownership, to say, instead of saying, hey, here's our budget, here's what we need to prioritize in order to move forward as a governing body, as a governor of a province, it was, oh, well, we're just going to ask this person, we'll ask this organization to build a road. No, you need to budget in to get, to be able to prepare for the floods that are coming, to be able to prepare for road construction. When an IED goes off, are you going to talk to the locals to get them to quit ruining your roads? Because the international communities, there's going to be some weaning off. And until they are able to understand that and grasp that they own their budget, then they're not, that was the biggest challenge. And I think we're going into our next question. that was where we made a difference, that we were able to truly get them on budget as far as they had to prioritize. They were able to go back to Kabul. And one of the challenges, sorry, I'm jumping around. The challenge was that the budget was owned by Kabul. It's centralized government. They controlled the budget. So even though the provincial governors were responsible and the people looked to the provincial governors for help in building a road or helping with a school, all that money was managed and controlled by strings up in Kabul. So that challenge of the province getting the money to fix things of what they need down here may not be in line. It sounds very similar to what goes on in our country as well, of what prioritized, you know? And so it was fascinating, but on the other hand, you saw them work through it. You saw them understand that, hey, I think as we started to say and start passing some of the bases over to Afghan National Army Control, they started realizing, hey, the United States isn't going to be here forever. And they started taking a lot more ownership. And so that was probably where we made a huge difference.
So I was able, like I said, to teach first aid classes. And even at one point, we decided to do a train the trainer class. Because as Major Kotsman alluded to, we're not going to be there forever. They need to start taking ownership and learn how to do things on their own. So after teaching a couple first aid classes, I decided that maybe we should do a train the trainer class. And we ended up doing one, and it went very well. And I was even able to supervise or oversee an Afghan-led first aid class. And it was amazing to watch them do it. The students listened really well when I taught the class. However, they listened better. They interacted more. They asked more questions when they had another Afghan leading the class. And some of that probably was because he spoke the same language and could answer their questions a little bit better. But it was kind of neat to watch that and be a part of that. And I mean, that's just one small piece in helping make them take ownership and do their own, start taking care of themselves. There was a big push in the medical community over there. We're slowly withdrawing the medical services that we provide to the Afghans. When they're out on missions, they're making the Afghans perform the first aid with U.S. medic assistance, but we're slowly making them take responsibility and do it on their own. That way, they're able to do it when we leave. A lot of routine stuff, when they'd come to the bases and ask for it, we kind of, not to push them away, but we would tell them they had to go use the clinics in their own area. That way, they can help develop. They can see that their providers, their doctors, know what they're doing, because in many cases, they're like, oh, the Americans, they know, the Americans can do it, the Americans can do it. So we're making them see that they can do it too and build that confidence in their own medical system. But it was, even though, like I said, it was a small part in making them teach their own first aid class. That was one of the first kind of advances we had done in our district in a while, so that was fun.
Just a few different ways that I thought we made a really big impact. One was being able to transition the power over to the Afghan people in Lagman province. It may not seem like a lot, but it is a huge step of being able to say, this whole area, we're done with. It is yours. Own it. And for them to be able to step up and actually do that was really good to see. The other thing I'd say, how I felt, day in and day out, no matter what, whatever it is we did, whatever we saw, one day we had to go to a school, open up a school to hand out school supplies. That school was for a all-female school in Parwan, and it was more of an elementary school. I have kids, so being able to go out there and give them something where, you know, my kids, if I gave them that, they would look at it and say, really, Dad, this is what you give me, you know? For them, it was huge. The look in their eyes, their reactions to it. That was a great day. That was a great day. She'd asked how large the province was. Area-wise, all I know, I guess I don't have an exact size or population. All I know is it took me all day to drive around it. 8 hours a day, I didn't cover the entire thing. So,
I think just making a difference is getting out to a couple of schools, giving school supplies out, just making them see that we're not the bad guys and we're actually there to help. Like he was saying, like, honestly, like, my guy's biggest thing was you give him a pair of new socks and they would say, they thank you for weeks. You put down a box of school supplies and stuff. You know, the hard part was making them actually share and split it up between each other because they do love hoarding stuff up there. They do. I've talked to a couple of the guys, the older guys that spoke better English, and he said it's because a lot of them are already, like, thinking ahead to when the U.S. leaves, you know, that what happens when all this is gone. So I think, honestly, getting them to share and just being able to split things up with them, and that way they start taking care of each other. Teaching them electricity and sitting down and doing classes with them and whatnot. You know, by the time I left, there's a couple of guys that I would trust as much as I trust an electrician, one of my electricians here or whatnot, as far as just, hey, no power here, and I could just send them on their own within the camps there as long as we're in camp and trust that they would do it. And I think we're making a big difference, and I'm proud of them, so, yeah.
Okay, so that pretty much gave our perspective of what we saw in Afghanistan. So now if there's any questions, wow. And also with the questions, please wait until the microphone comes around because this is being recorded for the radio.
This is KSKA Anchorage and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Air Force Reserve Senior Master Sergeant Chad Anderson and from the Army, Captain Shannon Osterfeld, Sergeant First Class Vincent Vetterkind, and Major Jeanette Kautzman. The Alaska World Affairs Council hosted their panel discussion titled Alaskans on the Ground, Experiences in Afghanistan, and Major Kautzman served as moderator. Following the panel discussion, audience members had the chance to ask questions.
Thank you very much for coming today. My name is Jay Jackson, and I not only thank you for your service, but I'm confident that some of the people that you dealt with were raised in an atmosphere that Americans are the devil incarnate. The positive image that you have left behind will last forever, and those children that received what to us is a small gift, they will remember that their whole lives. So I assure you, nothing you did was small. Nothing. And everybody should remember that change is slow no matter where you are in the world. I would like to know what concerns, if any, you have about how much personnel is left in this country to assist the Afghans after 2014. I hope that's not too pointed of a question.
I know where I was at. I was in Kabul. I think the NATO presence, as long as the NATO presence is there's enough support. I know the U.S., I mean, we're probably, 80, 90% of the troops there between the U.S. and the British. But where I was at, there was, 42 total countries. I think even though the U.S. may scale back, I think as long as there's a presence of NATO there, I think that it'll be okay, I think. I do.
Hi there. Thank you for coming. You mentioned several times the language barrier being a problem, and I'm wondering, do you think there should be more emphasis on so-called critical languages in the U.S., such as Persian and Korean and Chinese?
I'm a civil affairs officer, and so one of the things that I'm required to know a language, and so my language is Thai. That's what I have to continue to stay proficient at. I think overall in the United States, I think we get this false sense of security, and this is my opinion, of just learning English is good enough. I think languages are one of those things that you can always learn more of, even if it's just to communicate with a Mexican restaurant to be able to say something more. It's just that challenge of taking something else to the next level, that languages should be emphasized a lot more within our society.
Why do you suppose we can't define this as an aid project rather than a war? Who is the enemy? In the Second World War, we were pretty clear about that. We were pretty clear in Korea. We got less clear in Vietnam. And now, I don't hear any talk from any of you, any mention of an enemy. What I hear is you know, that you're nation building, which is great, but why is it called a war? And isn't it frustrating to be driving around an equipment that costs millions of dollars that breaks down because it's not really fit for Afghanistan and giving socks to kids, which they really appreciate? The disparity between the billions of dollars that are being spent on war and the mission that you all appear to be engaged in, which is noble, sort of drives me nuts.
Great question, thank you. So I think with the war on terrorism, it's definitely as far as if you look around. There's a lot of instability that has caused, and insurgents are known to be built because of instability, because of no education, because of or lack of literacy, lack of schools, lack of infrastructure, and majority of poverty. And so as you look at these countries, in Afghanistan, we're there as far as the development. There is an insurgency. There's those people who continue to put the IEDs on the roads. And those are the people that who continue to bring instability to Afghanistan. Those are the people that we're countering. Did that answer your question? So there is an enemy. It's definitely an enemy that each of us has felt in a different way.
Where I was down in southern Afghanistan, I know, listening to you sit and talk about Facebook and people over there, where I was in southern Afghanistan was very different than northern Afghanistan. Most places didn't even have electricity. There was no running water down there. It's a much poorer area of the country. There's very much a Taliban stronghold still down south. Our guys every day were getting blown up, getting shot at. We had one of the highest op tempos down south where I was. Like an op tempo, operation tempo. We had firefights all the time. There was a 1 week period in November of 2011 where we medevaced over 20 people out of theater. There very much still is an enemy, especially where I was and in certain areas of Afghanistan. From what I could tell, it seems to be almost pockets of places that are huge strongholds still, unfortunately. So right now, the emphasis on the war is winning the hearts and minds of the Afghans. So we work with their national security forces, their army, their police, and trying to win the hearts and minds of the civilians there. That way, they don't side with the Taliban. That way, we can decrease the Taliban presence and hopefully eliminate the Taliban presence in Afghanistan. We're trying to do that by creating a positive influence throughout the country.
I know in Kabul, where I'm at, all my guys live out in the provinces, spread across. Some of them take 40, 50-mile cab rides to work. And a lot of the spots that we would get a mortar from or whatnot, that's it. And on, just talking to most of my guys, the Taliban was there in most of their villages, and I think our presence of, with, you know, the ground troops and the MPs, everybody, they've been pushed out, and it's, you know, they've been spread apart and gave them an area to survive and to be able to work and learn a trade and do something rather than have someone with their thumb on them like the Taliban as far as doing what they're told. That's kind of what they, to me, I've been told once by one of the kids it was better when the Taliban was here, but that was like one out of 50 opinions. The other 49 or 40, 45 would tell you totally different. Pretty much they're more of a suppressed people whenever the Taliban was there. It was like they got told when to eat, they got told when to do this. With our presence there, they can go to school, they can try to learn a trade and to do better. So that's what we provided them, I believe. So I think if we pull out, then you're going to see the Taliban, you know, come right back in and start controlling these people again, as far as the people that want to do so.
For those of you who served in Iraq as well as Afghanistan, I'm interested in distinguishing between Arabs and Afghans. What makes Afghans unique, and will this make it more or less difficult to find an end to the operation in Afghanistan? Thank
you. As for the first part of that, what really makes them, I guess what the big difference is, For one, I could say education level. The Iraqis were very much more highly educated than what the Afghans are. As they had stated, the illiteracy rate in Afghanistan is ridiculous. Walking down the streets of Baghdad, I would run into most people who spoke English. We were sitting at a traffic light. It was a couple days before Christmas. It was in 03, and this guy walked up to my vehicle, and of course, I'm getting ready to react because I don't know what his intentions are. And he speaks English and says, Merry Christmas, because it was in a different part of town, and it blew me away. Absolutely blew me away. Never expected that there. The infrastructure, they have highway systems, cell phones everywhere, TVs. They don't have that in Afghanistan. You'll have cell phones, but those are used to detonate bombs. So they use them differently there. I prefer the way they used them in Iraq. But vehicles, you're going to see Mercedes, BMWs in Iraq. You are not going to see that in Afghanistan. Well, I saw one, and he was going really fast, and I don't blame him. I would have, too, if I was driving that thing. But I would really say the education level, the poverty rate in Afghanistan was unbelievable. Where Iraq, certain parts had huge amounts of money. Some were extremely poor, just like Afghanistan. So I hope that helps answer the first part of the question. as far as the second one, maybe you, the second part, I don't know, maybe he can touch on a little bit.
Will the differences make it more or less difficult to get out of Afghanistan or call it, find a stopping point?
I mean, I don't want to get too much in personal opinion because I'm not here to do that. Personal level, it would be more difficult just for the answers is that Iraq was there. It's a richer country. It is. And there, I've been to Iraq twice. I never really dealt with local Iraqis and whatnot. The interaction was not as much there. It's honestly, it's like night and day. Whereas in my Afghanistan trip, I'm around 40, 50 Afghans, or going through town in Kabul. There's like I think 15 million people. It's like New York City traffic, and all the roundabouts. And then it's kind of crazy, but it's just I think. The poverty levels and Afghanistan is a poor country as far as the majority of the people. It'd be Iraq. Just interactions with locals never for me. But then it's like they were more self-sufficient. I guess would be the best way to put that in Iraq.
Are there any specific examples that you can give us of, for example, an interaction you may have had with any of the Afghan locals that may have changed any of your preconceived notions of the area you were in?
Like I'll say, as far as everybody has perceptions from what you see on TV and whatnot, but like I had said before, I had my customer service guy, local Afghan. He has 2 bachelor's degrees, speaks 8 languages. He's way smarter than I was. So I mean, that's perception-wise, he was a good person to take with me across base. I used him as my translator a lot, interacting. You get perceptions, even not from just the Americas. You got 40-some countries where I was at, so you get perceptions. And I've had the perceptions that I sent Afghans to work on one of the buildings, and they refused to let them work there. So it's if I send certain people first, they give off a better perception, and that helps out and with all the other entities within our camp. But I would say that probably Omed was my customer service guy, so I think he changed perceptions of more than just myself, but of lots of people within our camp there.
Hi, once again, thank you for your service and everything. I'm Jacob Jackson. I'm a cadet at Eagle River High School, and I was wondering, for pre-deployment versus post-deployment, have you seen major changes in how you view environment, how you've changed personally?
I would find it extremely difficult not to change in any way. I don't know of anybody who has not in both of my deployments. You're going to, no matter what, you're going to experience things. Everybody's going to experience a different level of, pardon my French, but hell. Some, it's going to be, depending where they're at, not much, barely see any action, maybe spend a lot of time in an office, and then you have your different levels, and you go up to, our infantry and you know, in different areas, or are Marines in Helmand or Kandahar, yes, you definitely do change. And as far as pre-deployment to post-deployment, through the whole process, you still have guys that 6 months later, a year later, 2, 10, 20 are still dealing with things that they see, you know, or things that happen. So, yeah, just complete.
Back to the language issue. Were you given any training in the local languages?
I personally did not receive any training, but I know my unit received some training. I joined the unit right before they deployed. I got to Alaska, and a month and a half later, I was on an airplane to Afghanistan. So I missed all pre-deployment training. There is some language training, but it's, from my understanding, it was all very quick. They spent like a day doing it, and you cram a whole lot of stuff in. It's like rapid fire and very difficult to retain any of it. And other people, that's what everybody got, and there were some individuals that received a longer training, but I know I didn't receive any language. I received zero pre-deployment training, and that was just the unfortunate circumstance that I fell into. So
I think a lot of times it's dependent upon the unit. That there are a lot of training aids that are out there, as far as there's a lot of online, you can go to the Defense Language Institute, do a lot of online classes, and a lot of it comes down to the individual. But on the other hand, and I don't want to say that just because someone didn't learn a language, some of the local phrases prior to, doesn't make that, they just had to prioritize what was the most important. For me, I would rather have her really focus upon the medical portion than because there's going to be an interpreter there who's going to be able to support her.
And just real quick, the area I was in, it was Pashtun. It's a lot more difficult to learn than what you might think it is. I know people have gone through the Defense Language Institute and failed out because it was so difficult to learn. We learned little key phrases like get down, hands, that sort of thing. The stuff that, you know, that we could try and use to not have to shoot somebody, to get them to put their weapons down or whatever. That's what we learned, because at the time, that's what was important. And we picked up on stuff as we went. Talking to interpreters, you befriend them, find out all different types of words, you know, in every language, as we do, just out of curiosity. So that's how we actually ended up learning stuff.
That's the end of the questions due to time.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Air Force Reserve Senior Master Sergeant Chad Anderson, and from the Army, Captain Shannon Osterfeld, Sergeant First Class Vincent Vetterkind, and Major Jeanette Kautzman. They all responded to audience questions following their panel discussion, reflecting on their recent tours of Afghanistan, moderated by Major Kautzman. Alaskans on the Ground, Experiences in Afghanistan was hosted by the Alaska World Affairs Council and recorded in Anchorage on January 11, 2013. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Addressing Alaskans' theme song, Trampolines, is by Patrick Lee. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.